Welcome to ASA Central Line, the official podcast of the American Society of Anesthesiologists, edited by Dr. Adam Stryker.
Welcome back to Central Line. I'm Adam Stryker, your editor and host. We're joined today by Dr. Dave Dickerson, Vice Chair of ASA's Pain Committee, Clinical Associate Professor at University of Chicago, and Section Chief of Pain Medicine at North Shore Health Systems. Dr. Dickerson, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Dr. Stryker.
Well, as you know, September is Pain Awareness Month, and we're pleased you could join us to talk about pain management and somewhat how it relates to the current pandemic. And let's start there. How has the COVID-19 pandemic impacted the practice of pain management?
Well, all of our lives have become significantly more complex, and pain care has always been traditionally complex as well. It's really a complexity that's amplified due to the new rules of engagement that our patients and our clinical groups have to really acknowledge and implement to make sure that patients are safe as they seek their comfort from us. Pain is pretty complex as well in and of itself, in that it's typically requires an individualized approach, and it's a very biopsychosocial phenomenon with, you know, requiring sometimes multiple touch points of treatment, multiple therapies, oftentimes not delivered by the same clinical group. And then the overlay of stress in our communities right now on top of this has also further contributed to the challenge at hand.
Let's single out the stress topic, because we're all under stress with the current pandemic and everything that's going on, but specifically as it relates to pain. Can you talk a little bit about the relationship between stress and pain?
So we experience pain in many parts of our brain, including our limbic system, where our memories and emotions are stored and processed. So changes in limbic function can impact how we're going to experience pain in a given moment or over a lifetime. That's why stress reduction techniques are very powerful and effective. It's also why increases in stress can lead to increased pain experience. And pain, remember, can not only isn't just like the feeling of a hot poker, but it can also be our feelings. So it has an emotional layer, and that's really that limbic system component. Anecdotally speaking, we are seeing flare-ups as people are undergoing the stresses of all of our changes in our lives, and we're seeing patients perhaps experiencing more pain than they were at baseline. That's probably multifactorial, but it's really an overlay that we have to be conscientious of. And while those of us in this specialty recognize pain as a biopsychosocial disease or a psychosocial biologic disease, the psychosocial ramifications of a pandemic are definitely creating this interesting challenge and intersection for us as our patients are coming to us with new symptoms or exacerbation or even failure to respond to their current treatments.
Well, how have practices adjusted? Mainly focused on what creative solutions have physicians and other providers come up with to ensure that pain patients are getting appropriate care through this crisis?
So I think our advances really are honed in on both the efficacy of our treatments, which are challenged again by the ability to be face-to-face with our patients, but then also on the safety of our treatments and the safety of the management we may be providing in a more remote fashion. All this is also happening as we've undergone significant staffing changes, as some clinics have had to either shut down, downsize their staffing, or putting people onto furlough as the clinic was not able to be open. And then how you close down, reopen, and in between continue to provide access for your patients and their needs. Some of the creative solutions have really been many. But we really have to continue to try to leverage the concept of comprehensive pain care approach, because the complexity of pain has not changed. If anything, it's gotten worse. And so we really have to make sure that access to care is not just for phone calls or for prescriptions, but also actual care and reassessment. And I think that practices have adjusted in finding ways to really change the way we did business, where typically it was primarily face-to-face. We've now really move towards making sure patients can have virtual engagement with us, but really making sure that we maintain the meaningful value that patients get from working with us.
Do you think these restructured approaches benefit the patients in any way?
Well, I think the primary restructuring we're seeing is really a massive shift towards towards these virtual engagements through telemedicine platforms. And initially, I think until telemedicine was immediately available, we were seeking out any and every way to be able to let our patients know we were still there for them, including outreach phone calls and things like that, just to make sure that patients knew that they weren't on their own all of a sudden in a battle against their pain that they've really had a team helping them with. Telemedicine has really been one of the, like I said, main restructuring, and it does have significant benefits. Significantly bolstering access in a time where people don't want to leave their house, sicker patients who maybe are doing well and but just are at risk for viral transmission or contracting COVID, have the ability to check in with us, let us know they're doing well, let us know about new symptoms, or let us know that, they're thinking about us, which has happened in several of these interactions. So there are those benefits. And then also we're finding that through telemedicine, we're getting access to some of our colleagues that we collaborate with for patients that maybe would have considered that drive too far before. And so we're actually perhaps continuing to progress in how we scale up the assessments of our patients' conditions by leveraging this increased access via telemedicine. And that's been exciting to get to hear the opinions of our colleagues who perhaps were out of reach to these patients that now they can get to because of the telemedicine platforms that we've all worked to establish.
The upsides of telehealth, I think, are fairly apparent from what you're saying. I imagine there's a downside too.
Well, in pain care, you know, there really is only so much that we can do from afar, especially when you consider that some of our most high impact therapies do require potentially a face-to-face interaction. Also, changing a treatment plan where you're not able to have the patient in front of you and able to, you know, engage with you in that personal fashion where you can conduct a physical examination to really appreciate whether or not the sensitivity to light touch or whatever form of nerve dysfunction you had identified last year was really starting to abate. You have to direct patients to conduct, you know, specific neuro exams, which sometimes is just not possible, including important things to most of our practices like examining reflexes and things that really are part of more neuromuscular examination. That said, though, it's been fun to see how patients start to take our tricks for tracking their own symptoms or the severity of their symptoms as you've shown them what you're looking for, looking at 10L signs and things like that, or some of the other provocative maneuvers that we're now walking them through doing through the telemedicine portal. But the downside is also that we really lose some of the, I think, the transfer of empathy and care that is hard to generate in over an internet connection. And being able to be with our patients in an office sometimes is therapeutic in and of itself, so that they know another human is there for them and sees what they're going through and is able to affirm their commitment to their treatment. So our ability to offset hopelessness or inspire our patients to continue to be motivated and getting through this and getting through their painful days is something that I think telehealth at times challenges. And then again, interventional pain medicine can be so impactful for patients on their outcomes and quality of life. It's something that we've really had to start to think about getting creative with that and maybe using telehealth as a portal for us to really start to triage who needs to come for a face-to-face visit.
Many of us have heard the phrase, necessity is the mother of all invention. And although this didn't invent telehealth, this situation, it certainly brought it to the forefront and accelerated a lot of healthcare organizations embracing and utilization of it. Like with anything, there's pros and cons that we just talked about, but on the lion's share, when it's all said and done, as we move through the COVID crisis and beyond, how do you see telehealth playing a role going forward?
Well, I think it'll really continue to have a role, and I hope that the alignment of patients, payers, and providers will continue to make that decision together, and that payers will continue to make sure that it's as supported as face-to-face encounters, as long as providers are making it meaningful for patients. That access to a specialist that may not exist in a specific community can be granted with telehealth. And I think that that's very important because while we talk about going and getting traveling for a second opinion, some people aren't able to actually get an adequate first opinion in their communities, and telehealth creates a gateway for that. I think it will be a continued part of our pain care delivery model and hopefully for all of our care delivery. But I think that it's all about how we understand what the threshold is for escalating or pivoting into face-to-face care. I do think that we have to make sure that as we understand what reimbursement looks like, making sure it is commensurate, because the efforts actually for telehealth, in my opinion, are much more significant of a burden on the physician in that the open, the close, the medication reconciliation, all of the education where you might have handed some of that off to a team in the office, your MAs, your nurses. It's really all on you. And after a day of that, it's a whole different feeling. You kind of leave it all out there on the field as you've gone patient to patient in the virtual environment and maybe never left your office, but really tried to make sure the patients know that you're still there for them, again, I think we really have to be all in to help them feel like they're getting the value out of the experience. Because I do think leveraging the relationship and the care relationship in pain is a very important part of the therapy.
Does this allow for you to see patients out of state?
Yeah, so it does. I think different payers will have different restrictions as to how those networks cross state lines. But typically, we're in a tri-state area, and we have patients that we've solved for that for face-to-face. And with telehealth, the same rules have applied. But it is payer-specific, and it's good to know, network restrictions still apply. And so we try to respect those, and we try to make sure that we understand what that looks like. And the nice thing is in a tri-state area, that's not been a problem. But I think as we think about further and further reaches, we actually, one of my family members needed a second opinion for a complex neuromuscular disorder. And she was able to connect when we were down there visiting, with a group of specialists multiple states away that we knew that I had connections to have them weigh in for a second opinion. And having that personal experience, I can see myself advocating for making sure that even if you're skipping a couple states, that we create some sort of pathway to get patients access when patients desire that, need it. And perhaps at the end of the day, it will lead to patients spending less, having a smaller carbon footprint to enhance their care or enhance their knowledge of their disease.
Yeah. And, as we've used telehealth in the pre-anesthesia testing clinic, we found that it's certainly advantageous to a lot of families to not have to bring in, for pediatrics certainly, but throughout the anesthesia world, if you don't have to bring your family in to physically see someone beforehand, and understanding that there are probably going to be plenty of situations where you have to get tests and see other specialists. But if you can filter out some of those visits that are inconveniencing to the families, we found that it's actually, quite helpful in that regard. And it's been well received on the patient side. I don't know if you've heard any feedback from your patients or colleagues in that regard. Like, do the patients on the whole see this as a helpful thing, or do they see it really still as a hindrance because you don't have that physical connection?
Yeah, I think that's what's interesting. It's like most things in how we deliver care. It's not really one size fits all. And it is just another aspect of how we, engage in shared decision making. And some of my patients really are committed to using telehealth whenever possible, but listening when we need them to come in. And we've heard lots of positive feedback. Many patients have expressed that the convenience factor, especially if they're in a stable care pathway and they're doing well, that this has been a very valuable thing for them, and that they've not had to find someone to cover their job because they're now going to have a 3-hour experience waiting in a waiting room, seeing the physician, traveling to and from. But now they can actually check into the virtual waiting room, and in about 30 minutes to 60 minutes be said and done, and still be in the same place where they need to be for their next meeting. And I think that's been one of the things we've heard from a lot of our patients, is they really appreciate the convenience and that we've set this up. But then I have other patients that they really, after a couple telehealth visits, are longing to come back and have that face-to-face visit, because and some of them believe, and rightly so, that when they're with us, we may pick up on something different as we watch them walk or as we have the ability to spend time with them in person. And I think that it's all about, again, trying to meet the patient where they are and figure out what it is that they need at that time. So again, one size fits all probably is not the way to go. If all of my patients wanted to be telehealth right now, like we had for a significant period of time, I would say probably not for everybody would be my preference, and that some people we really do need to see them, track them in terms of their physical examination, but then also create some oversight, because there are a lot of behavioral aspects of pain that can be unhealthy, and we might not be able to detect how our patients are doing over the virtual portal or telehealth platform. And seeing them in the office and getting to spend time with them and see that maybe there's a little more psychomotor agitation, maybe they don't look well, maybe they look disheveled. The ability to get ready to leave the house and be with us is a aspect of daily living that maybe is a little bit less apparent when we're talking to someone sitting in their kitchen, maybe still in their pajamas, because they're at home and it is 10 in the morning. And that's something that I think we all enjoy sometimes.
Well, surely not everything has changed, and there are still traditional solutions to pain management that I'm sure are still being used. Do you mind talking about some of those?
Absolutely. So I think that as pain specialists, we've really, like I said, had to lean on the rest of our team for creative solutions. And the team can include neurologists, pain psychologists, physical therapists, and really watching what they've done to continue to engage their patients and provide their therapies. So it's been great to see that some of the stress reduction tools that our patients are using that might be app-based or might be more guided through a telehealth platform from those therapists has been it's been great to hear patients coming and saying that they're still able to engage in those therapies. As well, it's been great to see that the physical therapy groups we've been working with have been practicing with the CDC guidelines in mind for how to reduce viral transmission, screening their patients, and then making sure that patients that are at risk perhaps have less in-person interaction. The traditional solutions like med management, still highly available from us, and lots of states have worked to enact guidelines in terms of how patients that are on chronic opioid therapy can continue to and should continue to receive their treatment, even through virtual visits, as a way to continue to maintain the therapy and monitor the patient's safety. And so we are seeing that traditional solutions are still highly accessible. It's just that the way that we're creating those is really just not conventional. And it's a work in progress as we see what works. And as we see viral numbers go up and down in a various region and the need to move into different phases of precaution.
Well, let's talk a little bit about opioids, given the current climate. How has COVID had an impact on opioid use and or overdoses?
So there's clearly an unfortunate phenomenon behaviorally occurring from a public health standpoint right now, in that what we've asked people to do to reduce viral transmission is isolate themselves and stay at home. Unfortunately, that can be a very dangerous scenario for people who use drugs or for people who have substance use disorders, in that they may not have a social group within which they're using substances, and the margin for injury changes, and the ability to have someone there that can identify that an overdose may be impending is really challenged, or for someone else to say, I think something's going on here that's not very healthy for you. So that isolation really creates a significant challenge for people who perhaps are dealing with addiction issues. And we've seen overdose deaths increase since the beginning of the pandemic due to what we believe is this isolation, changes in drug supply chains, and the way that drugs are procured by people who use drugs. And then we're also seeing that over time, the deaths from fentanyl and fentanyl analogs, those overdose deaths are increasing. There's many different things that are contributing to that, including when we talk about access to pain care, access to addiction treatment also has undergone similar impact, and it already was challenged by the availability of those services prior to the COVID pandemic. And so we're unfortunately seeing that opioid-related injury is increased. You know, this is at a time where prior to the pandemic, we were seeing opioid prescribership going down, and we really have had a hard time teasing out. At this point, it seems that this is more of illicit fentanyl and fentanyl analog-related uptick, and we're yet to see the rates of prescribership to see whether or not opioids are perhaps being leveraged more at this time. What we're seeing is that in our practice, patients on opioids who may are having more pain, it's a solution that they've had at home to self-manage. And even if they're using those responsibly, with the stress overlay and the lack of access to the other treatments that have helped them, like going in a warm pool or making it to their physical therapy appointments or getting massages, without those tools, they're having less tools in the toolbox. And the opioids are still there for them if that is a part of their regimen. And so we've seen patients asking for increases in the strength or the number of tablets that they could take of an opioid that they've been taking. And we've been really conscientious as a pain group to not let opioids become a crutch at this time, because the risk of opioid therapy and that risk-benefit ratio really hasn't changed. Unfortunately, access to other kinds of care have changed, and we, like I said, have to be creative to make sure we're not heading backwards or over-leveraging higher risk treatments.
It's such a unique challenge to you and your colleagues that manage chronic pain, having to toe that line with opioids. It's a valuable tool, but obviously a tool that can be easily misused. And in this situation, as you pointed out, some of the other therapies may not be available to some of your patients, and trying to parse out which patients may need more and which may need less. It just seems like a daunting task. Is that true?
Yeah. So I think that's the whole idea. And that's, we sort of started talking about the individualized patient experience. and their assessments are individualized. And so we can still use our screening tools to look at how patients are utilizing these therapies. And these are validated tools that allow us to really assess whether or not a patient's risk of misuse has increased in this time. And so using those tools, even if over a virtual consultation and tracking those, can be very helpful to understand whether or not maybe there's something else going on. And oftentimes, there's a lot of reasons for people to feel sad or angry or frustrated right now. And that intersects with how people are able to self-soothe or feel pain relief or engage in a treatment plan, be motivated. And so those screening tools are helpful, but also using screening tools that really start to ask, is there a mood disorder that's beginning to develop for this patient? And we should all be worrying about possible major depressive disorder or even an adjustment disorder to changes in livelihood from the way the economy has shifted in terms of changes in workforce and employment and the way that even just the way that the government has offset some of that and how that's been a dynamic landscape. So we really should worry about untreated depression and how that can make patients more treatment refractory, especially since patients with chronic pain have a higher risk of depression and anxiety. And so screening these patients with not only risk tools for are they using their opioids appropriately or misusing potentially, but also screening them for depression, which maybe is not a standard part of the common pain practice, but it is something that is widely available and validated and maybe a highly influential intervention in someone's morbidity and mortality. So it's been interesting to really, again, move into the watching the psychosocial, watching patients change in terms of their behavior in this time. And I know that as providers, we're seeing some of those changes in ourselves as we take on more and more stress and try to adapt to the new normal, which seems every month to be different than the last new normal.
Well, let's talk about challenges. What are the main problems patients and physicians are coping with in regard to pain management right now?
So I think we have a couple areas of cognitive dissonance that we're trying to settle out here, or just conflicts of goals. But as anesthesiologists, that's what we do. We're usually faced with having to pick the lesser of two issues and then monitoring to see whether or not that was the right choice. So I think that we see that in a couple of domains. One, asking patients to leave their house, risking exposure, using PPE to protect ourselves and to protect patients and their families, to be able to deliver interventional pain care. We really have to understand that that's not a risk-free approach, but really calls into question, are we offering a high-impact therapy? Patients who've been on chronic treatment plans that have been responders in terms of reduction in disability and pain with our interventions, those patients are established as being responders and should perhaps have access. And I think you have a margin of benefit there. But patients who are exploring new therapies, we really have to look at the evidence in supporting those and being able to recognize that there is treatment failure with everything that we do. But the likelihood of treatment success and improving someone's ADLs is something that we have to balance activities of daily living or reducing their disability is something we really have to think about. And then even thinking about how different therapeutics have different risk-benefit margins in regards to maybe even increasing susceptibility to COVID transmission in certain patient populations. So the use of steroids, which can be immunosuppressive, there's been a lot of cognitive dissonance there in that I've had patients sending me articles about thanking me for giving them a dexamethasone injection because they just read that the World Health Organization is promoting dexamethasone as being a treatment for COVID-19. And so there's interesting overlaps here where the drugs are the same, but the clinical indication and context is perhaps not. But to patients, telling them that a steroid dose might be bad for them when that's being promoted for the treatment of COVID is another area of cognitive dissonance that we have to work through and perhaps leverage evidence that's not directly related to this virus or the injection you're going to do, but talking about immunosuppression and steroids. And that's a part of an informed consent discussion that we have with many of our patients. When I think about the need to provide these treatments interventionally, it really does come down to, again, an individualized assessment, but asking also, what's the impact of this treatment? And also, is it a treatment that I'm offering that might make it so this patient has no need to come see me in person for several months or maybe even until next year? And that then has a whole nother layer of benefit that we should be contemplating as we think about the risks of face-to-face care.
You know, I hadn't thought about that before, but you're saying that could be a disadvantage too. you don't want to withhold treatment, but do you weigh those risk benefits if you say, all right, I'm going to administer an interventional treatment to a patient. They may not come back, but I'm actually worried about this patient not coming back for a significant period of time. And if I do this, I may be putting them at risk for other coexisting diseases that we just discussed.
Yeah, so I think that actually opens up a whole discussion of proactive engagement post-procedure. It's like doing preoperative nerve blocks and going to the break room and telling everyone that your blocks work 100% of the time and everyone laughs because they know you've never gone to the PACU. It's all about how you actually follow your outcomes. And it's a broad discussion of that awareness and recognizing that when you're doing interventional pain care, a patient might go away for a year for many different reasons. And what's your level of engagement with that patient during or not during a pandemic to find out, did what you did help them and what is their total health, 3, 6, and 12 months after that? I think that you can create a framework for that vigilance of care. Or you could just assume that every intervention you've ever done for every patient that never showed up again is that they got better, which I am highly confident that's not the case.
Well, how do we balance the risks so we can change people's lives for the better while keeping them safe?
Well, the good news about most of the treatments, if not all of them that we provide, with the exception of maybe intrathecal pump placement, is that most of the care we provide doesn't require hospitalization. And it's typically a brief care episode that's often, if not always, ambulatory. Most of our treatments have minimal, if any, complications. And even our most invasive are still low-risk procedures. And I do think that these are things that, coupled with COVID screening for patients coming in, do create a balanced approach to being able to get some of these game-changing therapies to patients. There's also the risks of not treating the pain as well and sort of continue to manage in maybe a more remote or conservative fashion. And that's a path to go down. But asking at what threshold do you escalate and share some of the tools that you have that you've spent a career learning post-training as well as in your fellowships. And so there's really an ethical conversation here of deciding whether or not to provide these treatments. And we have to ask ourselves, I think, the idea of essential pain care and talking about threats to life and limb, which is a question we've all been asked across procedural medicine arenas during the pandemic, the idea of putting a time as to when people will be at risk is a real challenge because it's different for everybody. But when we think about the risks of despair-related injury or self-harm from persistent untreated pain, I would say that our position as pain specialists and advocates should be that pain care is as essential as the treatment of mood disorders during this time. And we need to mobilize all of our efforts, and again, in a balanced ethical approach, give people access and be willing to advocate that patients have access to that even during a shutdown if we're noticing certain facets of that patient's pain impacting certain facets of their life. And that's something that really requires ongoing engagement, especially if the patient says, you know what, I hear your recommendation, but I'm really concerned about coming in right now. And then the next time you talk to them 2 weeks later or 4 weeks later, their mood is worse. They have self-harm feelings at that point. At that point, the question is it time for an intervention? Probably not. You might have now moved into a space where you need to be leveraging a whole different set of treatments. And if you had perhaps been able to work with the patient to find a safe way to deliver that care, if pain was really one of the determinants in causing their disability and their low quality of life, an opportunity may have been lost there. And now you're pivoting towards managing the mood disorder and managing perhaps suicidal ideation, whereas the threshold for pain management was earlier. So I do think it's an interesting ethical consideration. And I think that everyone in this field really needs to be thinking about how we advocate for patients and recognize that uncontrolled pain is something that can lead to significant mortality.
Well, let's stay on that a little bit. The importance of patients getting access to this care. How has insurance coverage changed, if at all? And does it vary by system or carrier?
What we've noticed is we are really facing a continued, even pre-pandemic, you know, since the 2016 CDC guidelines that have really identified the lack of evidence for chronic opioid therapy and while establishing the significant risks, we're seeing that the partnership of our insurance providers has unfortunately moved in a separate direction that seems to be driven more towards cost savings. And the ASA, the AMA, AAPM, many organizations have come together to really make sure we're leveraging an evidence basis in support of comprehensive pain care, including interventional treatments. And we're seeing the access to care be really driven by cost decisions by some of the payers, and some policies continue to not provide access for their beneficiaries, some private insurances, to things that have level one evidence supporting their role in the treatment of complex treatment refractory pain syndromes. And having done dozens of peer-to-peers in the last month during the pandemic, where we've identified treatments that have a high likelihood of success for patients, and being told by other physicians in peer-to-peers that the policy just does not provide coverage for that treatment for this patient, despite the fact that they are opioid dependent or the fact that they have risks of that keep them from being able to be on other therapies, is really unfortunate. And it is a major focus for advocates as well as the ASA Pain Committee. And we really are going to be pushing to establish additional oversight of the companies that feel that that's a care decision they want to make, because we feel it is putting patients at risk. And it's also perhaps an expression of bad faith. So we really need our patient partners to also advocate for continued expansion of non-opioid therapies and interventional treatments, especially ones that have an evidence basis for them. And while the evidence basis may not be level one for some of these treatments, we may have retrospective studies, case series. That's more than we have for opioid therapy, which continues to be covered by almost all insurers, despite the opioid epidemic. And so it's very disheartening that here with the pandemic and with the need to deliver high impact treatment in a timely fashion, there is still an indirect overleveraging or suggestion that because opioids are cheap, they still remain in the algorithm while some of these other treatments are not available to patients who would benefit from.
Unfortunately, this is a battle that we've all fought for a long time, and it probably, unfortunately, is going to continue for some time. But is there anything that any anesthesiologists that are listening can do today to help in that regard with chronic pain management?
Absolutely. So I think that working with your state association or organization is incredibly important, as many of these policies are driven at a state level. Working with your representatives to the House and Senate to share with them individual stories in which even things like arduous pre-authorization processes are slowing down patients' ability to get this care is incredibly important. These issues are connected into the opioid epidemic and the ongoing opioid overdose epidemic. And it is something that without our bringing that to the attention of these folks is not going to help. The other aspect is to connect with the ASA's Washington office through the Pain Committee. If you do see something that's related to a practice that is perhaps not patient-centered or doesn't promote the best evidence in pain care, we really want to engage with individuals seeing this happening. And again, like I said, create oversight and let our partners in the insurance industry know that we will hold them to a standard that permits access to safe and effective pain care.
Well stated. And it's nice to know, you know, we're all trying amidst all the issues going on, especially this year, you know, we're all trying to figure out how can we help such big issues? But what you just laid out are some really nice specific targets to focus on for many of us within the field that a lot of us do have expertise on and can weigh in on with our local representatives and our societies. So I think it's important to remember that there are little battles we can win, even though you're in the sea of chaos, if you will.
Absolutely. I think that oftentimes what we notice is something that we don't think is right because we're clinicians, and it might be more of a personal encounter with how pain care is being provided or denied. And it might not even be related to something we've seen in our own clinical practice, but is coming at a very personal level. And when we have, you know, 76 million Americans with some sort of daily pain of significance that impacts their activity, that might be where we're going to encounter this more so than as we deliver anesthesia care. And so recognizing that taking a little bit of extra time to document what happened in terms of a denial of care or in terms of even a gap in how care is being delivered by a system or group, we all can grow together. And it's not just a insurance company area that needs to improve. Improvement really is something that we all should be engaged in. And interestingly enough, we are more likely to see it, or just as likely to see it on a personal level with friends and family in these times. And it's probably good that we apply our insight and judgment there as well, and then lean into our ability to advocate with such a powerful organization like ASA. And it is really impressive to see the lead that this organization has taken consistently to bring other groups together and leverage a very strong voice in terms of making sure pain care is becoming better and better with each year.
No, absolutely. Well, let's end this on a bit of a bright note. Tell us what's exciting in pain management right now.
So I think that we're seeing a entry into the field of some of the most talented residents in their classes going into pain medicine. It is a self-selecting field that may drive some people away and into other areas of anesthesia subspecialization, but we are seeing a ongoing uptick in just excellence in terms of the fellows that are coming in and want to become pain specialists. I think that's a reflection of their recognizing it's a challenging field that can be hard, but rewarding, and that it really does lead itself to lifelong learning. So that's incredibly exciting, is to see that the future of the field is really being built on a talented, exceptional group. Additionally, I think those individuals, as well as all of us who've been practicing, are incredibly motivated by the treatments that are emerging that we have available, because we can, in my opinion, provide people with quality of life that they didn't have before, and with a rate that perhaps we weren't able to employ before, and that a lot of the therapies that we've had for several decades have continued to advance and develop into treatments that are less and less invasive, more and more effective, and with a safety margin that really makes it much more palatable for patients to even consider these treatments. That really applies to some very specific therapies, and in a time like a pandemic where you want to limit the number of treatments you or the visits you might have with a patient, that safety and efficacy allows us to perhaps push the envelope in a way to give patients something that allows them to, on a personal level, live through these moments in a way that they might not have been able to without our care. Specifically, you know, some of the treatments that just are so exciting for me are the ability to treat spinal stenosis, a mechanical compression of the canal's contents that results in pain with standing and walking, and to be able to do that in a 20 to 30 minute procedure that under image guidance either bolsters a segment that has had degeneration and creates more space with a tiny spacer that's placed just under a small incision with image guidance, or by removing through a tiny tube little pieces of ligament that might be encroaching onto the canal. And with both of these procedures having level one evidence, an option that doesn't require steroids and also doesn't require hospital admission, has minimal restrictions afterwards. These are really great options that really, unlike an open spine surgery that might require admission or a hospital stay, really perhaps have a role during a pandemic for effectively treating patients with a high rate of success and a nice margin of safety, with both of those treatments having very low complication risks. Effectively, the ability to give people that function, it's really powerful, and it comes at a time too where anesthesiologists are entering into a space of becoming so much more, you know, just on the covers of major magazines, honoring the work that we're doing in intensive care units and emergency departments and operating rooms, managing the complex physiology and pathophysiology of COVID infections, or just managing other routine care in the area of this epidemic. It's amazing to see the many areas that were impacting our population's health and the way that patients are expressing their gratitude for that as we meet them in telemedicine visits and as they check in to see how we're doing, I think is a reflection of a partnership between our specialty and our communities that is perhaps reaching a pinnacle. And it's exciting to be there, especially when those things give us strength as we keep trying to go on in our own ways with our own families, trying to get through these very interesting times.
Absolutely. Well said. Let's leave it there. Dr. Dickerson, thank you so much for joining us and for this insightful conversation. And hopefully we've been able to highlight the importance of pain management, but particularly chronic pain management and this role that anesthesiologists play. And so thanks again for joining us.
Thank you very much.
This is Adam Stryker, thanking everyone for joining us on another episode of Central Line. Please join us again next time. Thanks.
September is Pain Awareness Month. Unfortunately, pain is the most common cause of disability in the U.S. today. Pain personally affects 1 in 3 people and causes more disability than cancer and heart disease combined. Untreated pain can be even more debilitating during times such as the COVID-19 pandemic. If you have patients with pain that won't go away, help them find relief with tips found at asahq.org/pain. Subscribe to Central Line today wherever you get your podcasts or visit asahq.org/podcasts for more.